Alright, time for another DoNutGod.com video presentation. A little too much of me. Anyway, alright, so I do a lot of physics arguing, actually I've been doing some live rooms, so I might invite that kind of participation, interaction, real-time interaction on these philosophical subjects. Maybe. We'll see. But anyway, it's probably thought-provoking in a way, in the sense that, you need some interaction sometimes to stir something up. And, that might in some way muse you into some kind of brain state that will facilitate the discovery of more relevant points, something like that. So I could argue that my doing physics and realizing how broken that is, as a way of modeling the universe, how big a mess they've made out of the reality. So in these videos, my intention has always been, in creating this channel in the beginning, was to argue what I think are the important value subjects. So I started off with subjects that were kind of related to this idea of fairness, the idea that that's what we're seeking in terms of our political and legal system, and that there's a whole bunch of conditions that we've created in the world that are creating a bunch of unnecessary negative outcomes, suffering, wasted. So the right to die, for example, was one of the important subjects. And the rest of it had to do with how to maximize a political system to produce the, to maximize the efficiency and function of what we establish as a civilization, the organization of the civilization. And that gets into the whole questions of branches of government and, checks and balances, lots of the cliche kind of terminology, one man's rights end where another rights begin, and those kind of value arguments about how you, fix what's broken. And I sort of made the general argument, that we write a constitution 250 whatever years ago, 300 now, and don't fix it. Just leave it in an outhouse. We have a bathroom, but it's not much of one, because we haven't done what is needed to be done, which is connected to all of these modern circumstances. So right now we're stuck in kind of a world where we're supposed to have free speech, but all of the mechanisms through which we speak are all privately owned. There's so little public space. There's like zero public space. In some real practical ways. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of free space in the middle of the woods, but I don't think when Jefferson was writing the, First Amendment, that the idea was you go out into the middle of the woods and speak freely to the trees. That's not the idea. The idea is that you have your share of access, whether people like it or not. You can go on the sidewalk and the people have to go to the store, the blacksmith or something else, and you're allowed to yell at them while they're doing that. And that was their vision of free speech. And we're a long way from that, in the sense that we aren't given, the advertisers have lots of rights to impose, but speakers don't have any rights to impose. Anyway, these are all subjects that, in my opinion, are important to creating a civilization and getting it right and efficient. And the one of the last conclusions is that the end game is really just to realize the whole thing is a fable, that none of this is going to be happily ever after. There is always the dilemma of our origin, our real construction, the pragmatic practical fact. The fact is that there is no happily ever after in the sense of there's no Prince Charming shows up, knocks the apple out of her mouth and they go out and live happily ever after. No, they go out and all kinds of traumatic shit happens. Their parents die, or their brother dies, or their kids die, and then they die. And, you know, there's no happily ever after. And there's no fables of the religious kooks, and, you know, sorry, religious kooks, but you're kooks, okay? You're, you know, you're believing something just so outrageously silly, you know, in terms of a philosophical or mechanical framework. You know, your God has to be literally insane to have not even mentioned bacteria in the Bible. I mean, come on, what kind of dirty trick is that? Yeah, you know, he sends us a one little message, his little book of bullshit, and we can't even put in there the little simple things like, you know, wash your hands after going poo. You know, come on, it's too ridiculous. There should be a background image. You know, whatever. Computers. I just noticed that. Anyway, I don't know why it's blank. it really doesn't make sense. I should go investigate, but I really don't want to do that. Ah, there we go. Okay, it's fixed. Not through any intervention of my own, frankly. So speaking of the inadvertent, you know, so there's subjects, you know, just involved in all of this stuff. So yes, I'm trying to tell people that basically there's facts, you know, and if you add up the facts, you're stuck with a conclusion. And efficiency means that, yes, if you really care about being good, you have to recognize that the best good you can do is eliminate bads. And frankly, there is no other job to do. And frankly, so the job is just to prevent creating the vulnerability to a bad. And so if you don't want any dishes broken, don't make any dishes. You know, it's kind of a simple answer. You don't want the bull to knock over the stuff in the china shop, close the china shop. You know, no problem, really. There are simple solution is to just recognize that all of this is just programming. We are just a robot. We're just doing the same play over and over again. It's just all a bunch of wasted drama. Now, to get to that conclusion, though, you have to go through all these little processes of recognizing certain truths and to put it up, you know, to get it into a rational theory. And so there's so many things that people are doing that are just so irrational. So there's some debate about determinism and this word free will. Now, I've explained that the concept of free is idiotic. You know, there's no such thing. There's just different kinds of cages, but there's no such thing as a free. There's just the absence of a cage. Just this, the same argument would be about good and bad. There's really no bad. There's just elimination. I mean, there's really no good. There's just elimination of bads. Those are all goods. When you prevent something, you're doing a good job, something bad. So, net bad, if you want to be more precise. All right, so through the reasoning process, so the subject of the free will and determinism, it becomes kind of ludicrous because most of the people arguing that determinism is false are arguing from a stupid premise, which is because we're random. So it's not like you have a better will. It's that you have a will capable of making wrong decisions. You're capable because the universe is randomized, and its randomness is so hot, it can't help but screw you too, that somehow you won't get 2 plus 2 right. So if I give you 2 plus 2 and 3 plus 3 and 4 plus 4, right, I just keep going down the line, because of the undeterminism, you know, you'll once in a while get one of these answers wrong. The randomness will break your native functionality to get right answers and create wrong answers. And somehow people think that will is somehow useful, that it's an enhancement, that somehow a free will, which just means a randomized will, is somehow superior to an educated will, or a smart will, or a correct will, or, you know, right answers versus wrong answers. Like somehow answers are all arbitrary and meaningless when, no, they're not. They're descriptions of reality. So we're all trying to just describe reality accurately. And how would a randomized description, how would you have a picture on your computer screen and I start breaking the pixels, I start randomizing the pixels? It's not going to make the image more visible. It's just going to break the continuity. It's going to break your ability to see anything of value. It's not going to make it better. So the only way you could make it better is you have to believe in some sort of God who's not randomizing it, but somehow improving your judgment. You know, it's improving your capacity to do the mathematics. All right, now clearly there's people that can, you know, they're given what we call a choice. And they have to figure out what to do. So you could call me, let's say I'm in the circumstance of a criminal, and we just make up this silly scenario of the, you know, there's a fat guy on the bridge, and then there's seven people on the train tracks, and I have the choice to save the seven people by sacrificing the fat guy. Right. And so I'm going to make a judgment. I'm standing there. And what's, you know, there's not really just two choices, push the fat guy or don't push the fat guy. There's run the fuck away. Okay, so there's a third choice, which I'm going to argue that I'm probably going to select, which is I don't want anything to do with this bullshit. So I'm not going to really make a choice. I'm just going to choose expedience and personal comfort. And, you know, so am I evil because I didn't take my opportunity to save seven people? Am I... would I have been evil if I chose to push Fatty off the bridge? You know, yeah, in my opinion, those are both lousy choices. It's a lousy choice, so there's no choice. And so you could argue that, you know, in everybody's mind, they have to make these choices. So all these criminals make all these stupid choices, and we say it's because they have some sort of will problem. Well, it's not a will problem, it's a math problem, because they haven't calculated their function. They've calculated their function to be what makes me happy. Okay, they haven't really bothered to add up the expense of making them happy. You know, how much do I cost? How high maintenance am I? I'm pretty high maintenance if I need to, you know, kill little kids or something, and, you know, to gain my gratification. Then maybe you're just a little bit too much of a vampire, you know, and you should just recognize your impracticality and make the right choice of saying, well, I'll just continue my function because my function is the one out of control. Now we're saying they're, somehow their will is broken because they haven't realized these obvious things. And but they had the knowledge available. Somebody like me said to the vampire, you know, you're outrageously expensive, you know, you're really not worth it. I mean, you cause all this harm and you don't really produce anything. You know, you're not really functional. You're not curing cancer or something. Why the fuck would why would we include you? If I was going to redesign the world, why would I put you in it? You're just a big negative harm drain. And so he heard that argument, but he ignored it, right? Because his will, okay, his decision making, wouldn't accept it, or ran from the decision in some respects, and just ran home to, I'll take care of me. You take care of you, I'll take care of me. Okay, catch me if you can. And that was his decision. So it's not like he decided to be an idiot or an asshole. You know, in his brain, he decided to be, I'll play it safe for me. Okay, which a lot of people do. So you could compare it in some respects to, say, me running away from the fat man dilemma, in the sense that, yeah, I'll run to safety and not be an advocate, not be a defender, not be a hero. And how much of a crime is that? I mean, you could argue that anybody in the trench, the grenade falls in the trench, everybody in the trench has probably thought about it a little bit. You know, what do you do? You know, when it's you and your 10 other guys and, you know, you have this decision to make. You know, look, it's just a practical fact. I jump on the grenade, they live. I don't jump on the grenade, they die. No, and the truth is, it's a real a decision as when one of these psycho killers is going to decide to psycho kill. It's not that dissimilar in that their outcomes are real. There's a real outcome. 10 people are dead instead of one person is dead. Blown up, whatever. Whatever that means is a negative experience. And then that gets into a whole nother argument, about, what, you could theoretically calculate your way out of it. Because you could calculate that, well, if I let the grenade blow up, they'll be killed, okay, pretty quickly. But if I jump on the grenade, they're going to get damaged, but not killed. So they're going to go through a whole bunch of harm. They might get their eye shot out, with a piece of shrap metal or some other kind of injury, be very painful, ruin the rest of their life, they become an alcoholic, blah, 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 some kind of bullshit. They have to have their leg amputated, some sort of other bullshit. So I'm going to be creating more harm, okay, if I do jump on the grenade, because now I'm going to create injured people instead of dead people. I mean, it's a real dilemma. It's a real thing to think about is, if you're going to kill somebody or you're going to injure somebody, maybe you're better off killing them. Because maybe injuring them is, in fact, the worser of the evils. Because it's going to involve a lot more trauma and the implications, the dangers of it. And so this is the same decision, people having kids, there's all kinds of unknowns, in terms of, well, you can believe your kid's going to be a huge asset to the world, but maybe he's going to be a huge deficit. He's going to break hearts and, leave a trail of tears in his wake. It's real, and all of that's part of having a rational conversation about the dilemma we're in the sense that we're playing a game for which we're completely ill-equipped to do the right thing because there's too many variables. There's too many uncertainties in terms of outcome that don't give us any ability to place appropriate value on anything. We can't know what's a diamond and what's a piece of glass. We can see a little superficial sparkle and that's it. And we're going to make real decisions about destroying, things of huge value because we can't tell the difference between, the glass and the real value. And so that's much of, what I'm attempting to do. Now, I've done it, rather crudely, all right? I didn't, it's perspective, age, maturity, all these words have something to do with how you progress as a human being, and I would argue that I'm more equipped to make an argument, now than I was 20 years ago, but I'm also more fatigued by the tedium of this process of conveying this arrangement of words. So that was something else I had thought about, was just how I'm, one of the flaws in my function is that I don't, writing doesn't appeal to me, okay? Organizing doesn't appeal to me, partly because it's still too abstract. You can't be certain of anything you write down on the piece of paper. There's too much uncertainty, and so there's a... That's a dissidence for me, because it seems a commitment, to have it and as a written statement is almost like a permanent quote. And it's like you don't want to allow the vagaries of poor verbiage. You said it the wrong way, you used the wrong word in the wrong place. And so that kind of pressure inhibits my capacity to just have the conversation like I have this conversation. I'm letting my brain construct this argument. And letting is a tricky word, right? It's what the program is saying, okay, is yes, here's the mission, and then, it has a start and it has an end, but it doesn't have the stuff in the middle, kind of like the underwear gnomes in South Park. It's missing, A it has, and it has C, but it doesn't have B, how to get there. and it's just letting B happen. And that's kind of sloppy. And, you know, it's kind of the downside of these videos is that somebody could say it's a rant or a ramble. I guess in the past I was ranting and now I'm just rambling. You know, and that's not great. But the idea of presenting a script, well, I'll get an actor to do that. You know, somebody else can do that. I'm not the presenter, I guess, is sort of the argument. Is I'm attempting to construct what should be presented. It's the message I'm trying to construct, not messengering. I'm not an expert at messengering. anyway, so I just think about that process, right? My brain is constantly talking, but doing the idea of just letting your brain talk and writing it as you talk, my brain doesn't do that. Yeah, sorry. Maybe it's just partly because I can't physically do it. I'm not typing, I'm not great at spelling, all that kind of stuff, so my brain doesn't have any continuity, and so there's too many, it's too slow a process. And the slowness means I had 15 thoughts, and I only wrote down, you know, 3 words. And so I'm way behind, and so it's harder to get the message. So, but eventually, okay, which I've tried a few times, and I'll try it again, as I did series of videos on key words. So the idea that there are key words and key concepts. And, you know, I could argue that if you understand yourself to be a programmed robot, that is, there are no reasonable quantum fluctuations that are, you know, spirits or ghosts controlling what you think, okay, and that what you're thinking and what you're believing and what you say and even how you say it has all been just programmed by your life experience, and that if I changed a few years of your life or a few days of your life or even a few seconds of your life, I could in fact go back in the past and just change who you are now, because I took away you know, one of these key elements that you're building your car out of. Your philosophy is a combination of a bunch of parts, you know, the wheels, the fenders, the frame, and sort of the argument being made is that if I'm going to create an argument that everybody can see, that is an argument that works on any human being, it has to go through all of the processes so there can be no objection. It has to explain, here's the frame of the car, here's the wheels of the car, right? Here's the engine of the car, here's the drivetrain, you know, here's the differential. You know, you go through each little piece and explain why they're essential, what its function is, and then there can't be any argument about when you have the finished car and it runs and it does what it's supposed to do, that yes, you've done it well. And so that's sort of the idea of modeling, is to create something that not only provides a solid answer to a question, but also shows how that solid answer is derived, where it came from. And that it's well-founded, you know, that you can... See, I can easily argue why wheels need to be round. You can make a physics argument about why round is the best shape for the wheel. Okay, it's going to work best. And, you know, those kind of explanations are what you're seeking, is to explain each part of the philosophical machine model by explaining how there's really no other way to see it. There's no choice. There's no freedom to see it some other way and call yourself reasonable or fair to the facts or logical or, you know, one of these good things to be called. And so that's the project. So in thinking about those key words, and I was sort of paralleling it to the physics argument, because the physics is so, it's so abstract and so convoluted and so full of shit, and yet they all talk as if they have this really great model that does all this great wonderful things and it always works and it predicts everything and it's none of that's true. and it's a mess as a machine. You can't possibly understand. I mean, the smokestack is going, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, some sort of human centipede thing. It's really disgusting. As a concept, it's got, you know, these connected ideas that can't possibly fit together. Relativity and quantum mechanics is sort of a famous one where the foundations don't match. You know, one of them is basically saying there's a real universe, a real world, and the other one's basically saying, no, there isn't. But it's not even, see, I can't even say that this quantum mechanics really is. It's saying it's an unreal world in a different way, you know, a completely different unreal world that they both describe, I guess is the way to say it. Well, I'd argue the simple answer is there's a real world, and that's the one you ought to describe. But anyway, and the same thing exists in philosophy in the sense that there's, you know, the philosophy in the sense that I would call anything philosophy that's dealing with the harder questions, which are the value questions. So anything, the efficiency of how much gasoline you're using and how efficient your machine is and how efficient your culture is, all of those are philosophical questions because they're not just relying on raw physics. Physics can't answer the question. It doesn't have anything, any tool to answer the question. And yet, because you're applying, you know, you're testing with this device and you can't test with any other device. I can't feel your pain. I can't sense your senses. I can't experience your experience. I can only experience my experience. And from everything I've experienced, it seems these are kind of easy to answer questions regarding value. You know, I can experience the cavern of difference between feeling good and feeling bad. I know it's a gigantic difference. So I know there's a huge range of value possible, positive to negative, mostly just negative, that you can barely be. You know, your toe can be in the quicksand, or you can be into the quicksand up to your hair, you know. you know, they tell me how deep does the pain go, more than any other conversation that's worth having. From my tasting of the world, that's all there really is. There's just a lot of bad tasting things. It isn't that anything tastes good, it's just that relative to the bad tasting stuff, yeah. So, you know, it's all just making comparisons that, oh, it's a lot better to have one broken leg than two broken legs. And that's all you're really saying is that how much am I being relieved of extra burden? And that's what will decide how good I feel. That's my experience of tasting life. And you could say there's a few tiny exceptions of euphoria. You know, you're drunk just the right amount or something. Some sort of experience that transcends the rules and gives you some sort of experience that doesn't seem to be related to just getting you out of a negative frame of mind. But, you know, one could argue pretty simply that, well, no, being drunk is just doing that. It's just escaping your worries. Okay, and that's why it feels good, is because it just took away negatives again. So I've made those arguments. Yeah. And so really it's just the value of our little personal narratives. You know, there's a story we tell, and the story's about somebody's practiced doing something, and it's, you know, time for the, you know, where they're going to be able to have their Olympic moment, and, you know, they catch a cold, you know, and the whole thing is lost, you know, 10 years of practice thrown away, you know, over nothing. And, you know, we'd all lament and cry and say, well, isn't that just horrible, and oh, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and that's basically this argument about being at all pessimistic or negative in talking about the life experience is doing the same thing. It's telling a story that people just don't want to go there. They don't want to know that it's a sad story, that the outcome isn't fixable, that there isn't some way to make it all better. They want to believe, okay, that they're going to in some way escape. the price being paid, and you know that they're going to get some to some place where the same rules that have been applying for millions of years won't be applied anymore. It's pretty unrealistic and mockable and all of that, but that's part of my job, is to mock it without being too aggressive, and to do it in some way where the person with these perverse values, and frankly they're quite perverse and disgusting, these molesters, that I convince them of their negative function without offending them. So that's pretty difficult to do. So that's why you have to build this thing in pieces, and just so show how. Well, look, if you have these six pieces, you're done. Okay, the basic idea of the car is built. You've explained the model. You explained the function. This is how it works because it all fits, and that's the mission. In both cases of talking about the physical reality and talking about the value reality, they're both just things to be described with a model that explains how the pieces work. All right, so I'm going to get to the subject of evolution because that's one of the key words. So I would argue that I have stated that if you believe in evolution as a process, you really do have to concede. I mean, it's a big, giant, ugly fact. And that big, giant, ugly fact is almost the only one you need. It's almost like saying all you really have to understand about a car is motor. You know, and that's enough. You know, just motor. And you could almost say, you need these tiny little extenders that make the wheels turn. But that's all you need, is to sit on the motor with some wheels and you've got the car. You don't need the fenders and all this other bullshit. And you can even turn it by, shifting your weight. So you almost don't need the steering column. So you can strip the model down and get the essence of it. And the argument would be is that evolution is the essence of the argument. It's the story of who and what and why and all that crap of our existence. And it's not a good story. It's a really shitty story. And so maybe I'll talk a little bit about that. But I mean, it's just the idea that this is a key concept, a key word. And if you do any honest evaluation of the word, what it's describing, the concept, there's no way to make any kind of redeeming conversation about how it's heading somewhere or going somewhere or doing something or any of that crap. It's an insidious, psychotically indifferent to the very thing the whole point of philosophy is to do, which is to find goodness and maximize it versus bad. It doesn't even know the difference between the two things. I mean, clearly a process that is just doomed to catastrophic failure. Couldn't possibly come out any other way, because it's playing with diamonds it can't appreciate, so to speak, the precious. I take a little break and we'll see where I go. Alright, I'm back. Alright, so I haven't put together any organized, just the subject of evolution. Okay, you can just take this one subject with one. It's like the car engine, and you can take it apart. You can dissect it and explain all the mechanics of it and how it works and why it functions. So you can give a very detailed explanation of, how you decide what metal to use, how big a bolt to use, how all the different reasons and explanations for why it has to be a certain way to, protect against certain this or that. So you can do a lot in terms of explaining in great detail the function of something like evolution. And just going through the stages of the living things, like the first stage of life was this simple stuff, right? No brains, no issues, just little machines. So it's a little robot world. And the roboticness was more was so much more obvious, okay, than it is in us, right? I'm saying we're robots, but nah, we're not obviously robots. But the first life forms are obviously robotic in a sense. You can just follow the little machinery. You can see that it's just, you know, no one's going to say that because this goes from here to here that some meaningful value thing has happened. You know, it's just a simple, you know, movement in space. It's not, doesn't involve any feelings. Nothing has to create a consciousness and all of the elaborate functions that go with it. So I guess you could separate that whole subject of the brain's evolution versus the body's evolution. And, you know, they're almost very distinctly different conversations. Almost like as big a difference as talking physics versus talking biology or chemistry. Same thing, but very different. In some ways, you know, one premised on the other. But anyway, so yeah, you know, I'm just talking this rather than reading the script or even any notes. So I'm cheating the function. So I know in the future what I'll do is I'll do that. I'll start writing the words again and writing the key bits to that story. So if I just let my brain say, well, what's the key things to talk about? Well, the key things to talk about are these different plateaus that, you know, life has to get through to become what we are. You know, to become complicated, more complicated, to carry more functions. So sitting on an engine with wheels, you know, you can't have a, you know, a spinning gun or some other, you know, you can't add other features until you add the infrastructure for them, or you just tip over or something else. There's rules to how you can add complexity. And so you have to recognize the fact that you have to have this, to bake this cake, you have to go through this whole process. The cake just doesn't bake. You don't, you know, and the process is the point of, that the whole argument is that that process has no capacity. It's not an intelligent process. The process is a function. And the function is just this idea of replication and the idea that the things being replicated are in a container and they must compete with each other. So you could say that you could cut it down to those two principles. You know, that you're making machines that copy themselves. And the durability of the machine, the copy, where copies get into the future, will just be dependent on how well they survive inside, you know, the crucible. That's it. And there's no standard to go in. There's just the what the contestants look like. Okay, so you start with contestants, which, you know, the initial ones would just be pieces of chemistry competing with each other. Circumstances, you know, how much lightning or how much ammonia gas or how much anything is in the atmosphere, and that decides the initial function, and from that initial function it just evolves. It just goes through the different matching of the contestants, and you know, and there'll be a lot of arbitrary and unearned victories, you could argue. Just by circumstance, bad luck. You know, a rock falls and crushes the best guy. You know, the guy who would have succeeded and killed all the others and blah, 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 and won the day. But now you got, you know, a rock fell on him. So the first things evolve as just machines. And you could just say, well, that's interesting, but it's not a value question. It's not a philosophical question. So it all seems quite, who cares? Okay. Chemistry goes this step further where it makes little replicating machines. And the little replicating machines can do things. You know, they can flash lights even. You know, they can change color. They can, you know, they can do stuff to make it recognizable that it's something doing something. Okay. It's changing. It moves its position, you know, it does things to indicate it has a function, okay, it's not just sitting there. But I suppose it wouldn't matter whether it did just sit there, because the idea would be is that it's like musical chairs, there's so many seats, and who gets to sit in the seats will decide who exists in the future. So there's lots of ways to analogize the process that decides who wins and who loses, and what functions will be rewarded, and which ones will be, won't have the opportunity to exist in the future, or something like that. I mean, they have to try again. That idea has to be retried. And that sort of gets back to just something I said maybe last week or whatever, that, you know, it's like the Jaguar is a duplicate of the same kind of machine, right? The Australians had they called it a tiger. I mean, didn't look that much like a tiger, frankly. The same idea of the physical structure of predator and the physical structure of prey often become a standard, that there's more than one version and the versions look very similar. So they come from, you know, different sources and end up looking like the same thing because, frankly, the function requires the same kind of attributes to be able to overcome the predator's advantages. All right, like hopping legs, that kind of stuff. All right, so it's a pretty deep subject in terms of going through. First, look, you have to concede that the origin is robots. The origin is little machines. And then you can sort of recognize that what are you really changing is just giving them attributes, tools, as I put it. So evolution just creates tools. So with each mutation, with each forced change, okay, and it's just error code. So the Xerox machine can't improve something because something thinks on it and gives it spiritual energy or some other bullshit. That's not what's changing things into something different. What's changing them is just errors in the Xerox machine. So it makes a mistake, and the mistake just happens to be a happy accident, and it gives something an advantage, you know, a harder fingernail or some kind of advantage that is durable because it's useful. It helps the future organism survive, and that's the incremental stages of improvement require these defects to be created, these subtle changes, and they work with each other, like a little change in this and a little change in that, and then you add up all those changes and that becomes a brain, for example. But I really don't want to get to brains until I finish. The point is that one of the foundations of the mechanism is that this is really just a robot war. It's just a war of machines. And, you know, we can think we're something other than machines, but that's all it is. It's a physical, biological machine. And it's the biology loses its gooiness or its strangeness, or I don't know how the right word to use. The fact that we feel disconnected from it, it doesn't seem intuitive or comfortable, at least not for me. Okay, that I'm full of this liquid and all of this gooey crap. But if you go deeper and deeper, you can start to get to the chemistry, and the mechanical parts start to look like mechanical parts again. It gets to look like just crap moving from point A to point B. You know, you can start to see the levers, the simple mechanical devices that are making things happen. You can start to see that structure in the mechanics of the device. And theoretically, you could do that by, you know, people do it. You know, they attempt to model the brain's function. And they use words like neural net and other kinds of, well, I might argue, crap. But regardless, it's some effort to recognize that we can get to the machine level of the function and recognize that it really is just a lot of little processes, just little mechanical processes. And there's just so frickin' many of them, okay? That's what adds up to you. So you're a lot of little machines. So that was another big transition, you would say, in the history of our existence, is the transition from being little machines to being machines made of little machines. And that's it's a huge transition in evolution, right? Where the DNA molecule is making this machine, this complete cell that functions and does all these things, into now containing code that tells all the little machines how to line up and arrange themselves into this, you know, multicellular organism. So it's a huge change in the foundation of the machine. I can't really provide a car analogy because there's no little motors inside of the motor, okay, of the car. So, you know, you could almost argue an electric car, maybe you could argue that there's a bunch of little magnets, you know, created inside every big magnet. So the big magnet is made of little magnets, but that function is the same. It doesn't make it any different. The little magnet, it's doing the same thing the big magnet is. It doesn't change the function entirely, where we are a community of slaves to function. The cells are configured by the DNA to be a liver cell or a kidney cell or a different cell, you know, it's all obliged to be in the structure, because the structure is what has to survive. And so everything's all the little machines are now not only robotic, but they're in a slave environment. Okay, they're in a container, they're not in the real world. They're now obligated to exist in this possessor's world, to make the possessor function. So it's one of those things. I'm just saying that your brain should be a little bit intrigued, or, you know, triggered. There should be some kind of response inside your brain saying, gee, that really isn't insane. It's hard to even imagine this transition from, you know, making this, you know, to making this, you know, to go from a single cell to something that's a whole bunch of cells, but they all have a different job and they all have a different function. And that function ends up being this much more powerful machine. So these multicellular organisms, they not only got big, because they kind of had to be, bigger, because they're not just a thin membrane in a fluid. So I guess that was one of the limitations. It's pretty hard to make a terrestrial single cell. It's hard to do. To make it durable, as a cell, because it has to create a more complex crust. And then it has to have some ability for its arms and legs to move it around, and, you know, and how they attach and all that. So it's hard to make the single cell, even a bug, kind of single cell bug. They're all kind of dependent on just being in the, you know, the origin soup of a fluid. And then you can see that about us, is that we're really just a bucket of seawater. You know, we're just a container that contains a bunch of seawater to keep our cells comfortable. Because, yeah, they have to still, they still have the same limitation, that they're not terrestrial. And they need to be fed, and they need their waste taken away, and they need all these things to happen, because they can't do any of that shit. They're still really crude and primitive, in a way. I shouldn't say crude and primitive, because obviously there's cells that are so advanced, like neurons, that, you know, they can be, you know, 3 feet long or whatever, 3 meters long, and, convey all kinds of information through them. They have all kinds of capacity to transmit electricity and do different things. So they're hardly simple, are of crude design, crude mechanism. That's a better word to use. All right. So there's a whole bunch of those kind of things in evolution, where you could just argue, you know, the first brain. So you're talking about all these machines. So even when they became multicellular, they're still functioning, you know, in this crude way of just, it's a DNA molecule, you're just going to give this machine tools. So it gave it tools of these different organs that could process things and provide greater efficiency. So it had better ability to process the oxygen, convert sugar into energy, do all these different things. So all of that stuff that we're taking advantage of in terms of our function was developed in these earlier robots, okay, that acquired these organs. And so you could go back to something like a fish, and you need to go back a step further to even get to, you know, the fish doesn't have much of a brain, but it does have a pretty developed brain. lots of complex control mechanisms, and besides just vague control of reflexes, it almost has agenda built in terms of programming and a sequence of events. You know, the salmon, you know, figure out, okay, there's a mechanism, a trigger, and they swim up the stream and their body changes and everything, you know, their function changes. They're, you know, made, and then they're doing it in this, you know, and it's another example where you could see the slavery of the system. Like even the things with brains are slaves, okay, to the DNA, slaves to the agenda. And the agenda is if you're going to be successful in the future, you know, you have to be smarter than your adversary. So you have to hide your eggs way upstream so they don't get eaten by all of the other competitors. And on top of that, you have to die, okay, and allow yourself to decompose so your children have something to eat, okay, while they go back to the sea. You know, these are all mechanisms that proved strategies, behaviors, okay, that proved to be successful, and they're just slaves to them. You know, and then I could make the argument that, you know, humans have escaped that because they've converted their scheming brain, you know, a brain that has the purpose of just coming up with ways to learn ways to evade problems, escape drama, maximize their victories versus losses kind of thing, pick the right time to fight and the right time to run. It's a scheming brain for your survival, and clearly we're capable now of using that crude device for something more abstract, in the sense of something less connected to personal genetic survival, and we can have conversations as if we weren't selfish bastards. I mean, we can actually turn off our own personal interests for a while, and we can try to just talk about 2 + 2 without talking about whether I was ever raped by a 2 or why I have a bad feeling about 4s, or, you know, without a bunch of subjective crap, you can have some sort of logical conversation about what the truth is without spilling a bunch of biological reflexes, historical reflexes on top of it. So we take this brain that's really made for the selfish organism, it's a tool for the selfish organism, and we can convert it pretty easily into something that just does the pure logic. So instead of figuring out how I get past the tree, it can figure out how somebody else can get past the tree. You can just apply it to somebody else's circumstances, or you can turn it into an abstract of the, you know, best interest of the human race. And we can use our brain to figure out how, what's the best strategy for success. All right, so it has a bad origin in the sense it was just a malicious brain kind of developed to make you into an excellent murderer, and we can apply it because we have philosophical knowledge of value not existing in ourselves but existing in lots of other places. And we can just simply argue that, yes, I can apply my scheming brain to scheming solutions, okay, that are thoughtful and logical and don't have the purpose of just coming up with an answer that benefits my genetic code. Right. That's not the best way to say it. I'm just saying that it's clearly you're just changing the scheme agenda into the scheme is solve the puzzle. So our brain can just sit there and, you know, it almost likes it. Almost we're constructed to like solving problems. We like seeing something broken and being able to see how to fix it. That appeals to us by our nature. So it was clearly something our brains were doing in the past. Was the whole point of being able to think and to learn was to learn how to solve problems. Learn how to throw a stick at the bear kind of thing, and that the pointy stick works better and all that kind of crap. Step by step, acquire better knowledge about how to solve a problem. All right, so that's not too bad. I'm already at the end, but I didn't, you know, I just took a huge shortcut to get there. And so, again, the idea is that there's people who think that, okay, on top of this subject is a idea about what the universe is doing, and that somehow the universe is really just here for living things to grow on the surface of planets. And, I'd argue that's, you know, kind of silly, and that it can be argued that, well, if you take even a kind of a superficial view of biology, you can recognize that there are these bizarre circumstances that arose, that happened, and the whole evolution of life is dependent on these events that only happen once. I mean, there's only one way you get to brain, and that is through a neuron. So without the invention of the neuron, there's no brains. And so you'd have to argue that every thing that was going to evolve into something that could do any thinking would have to come up with something like a neuron. But here we are on a planet covered with parts, and it doesn't make something else that works. Okay, it doesn't have some other version of the silicone chip. There's no other version of it, where we could obviously make lots of mechanically different versions of a computer chip. We could do it out of lots of different things. Yes, it would have to be bigger. It wouldn't have some of the advantages, but we could do it. But the point is that nature doesn't do it. Nature didn't do it. There's no evidence that it does it easy, that it happens all the time, or any of that. And that's just one tiny little hurdle you have to jump over to get to the idea that the universe does consciousness. You know, that this is what it does. Even the idea of creating the feeling brain versus just a thinking brain is a whole nother hurdle, a whole nother curiosity, okay, in brain evolution, that it would make that bizarre jump from just being a knee-jerk, that is just calculating sense information and creating a muscular response. It's doing it through now this feeling mechanism and then the response, because the feeling mechanism is just giving a taint to, you know, whether you run or you fight. It's giving you the capacity to have this, it feels good, it feels bad, it needs fixing, it doesn't need fixing. It's a yes or no mechanism. It's a really loud one that says things are getting better, things are getting worse. It's a huge source of information in terms of formulating a strategy. It tells you, gives you this abundant amount of feedback in terms of even controlling the damage to your own systems. So just by creating these feelings of too hot, too cold, it doesn't have to monitor temperature directly. Okay, you can just do it in that indirect way. How do I feel? All right, and I could make the argument that that's all essential to creating a learning machine, is that it has to have something that places value, that assigns value to a right answer versus a wrong answer. Success has to mean something to the organism for the organism to learn from it, and that's the role that feelings play. So, in a way, in the process of trying to make value in circumstances, like to make the DNA molecules essentially saying it has to give the predator some idea that its life is valuable, that its welfare is valuable. And the only way to give it that idea is to give it a notion of harm, pain, a negative, something to run from, something to get away from, something that requires immediate and attention. And that's why feelings create an advantage for an organism. It's because they consolidate something complex into something very simple and do it fairly consistently. Now, obviously, we can have feelings that are totally inappropriate, and we can feel bad in good situations, or we can feel good in bad situations. So it doesn't always get it right. And obviously, people can be gratified by doing very horrible things, because there isn't good programming. It's not rationally oriented to the world that exists. Just broken as a detector of good and bad. So that's probably enough. So that's where I'm heading, is attempting to identify the key meaningful concepts or words and just emphasize them in terms of creating this complete understanding that, you know, if you recognize evolution, you recognize the idea that's creating robots, you recognize that the battles have all been done billions of times, that it's a play that's been running way too long for no accomplishment, but to keep fixing problems it creates. It spills the milk and then cleans up parts of it and feels all proud of itself, and leaves a bunch of festering pain in its wake, unresolved, unsolved, the unsolved portion of the problem, and it's a gigantically significant unresolved problem. The 9 dead lion cubs for the one that survives. You have to have a solution to that problem. You can't just say, well, nature says so. It's okay with nature. That's not using your brain very well to say, you know, I don't have to do any better than nature does in terms of measuring value. No, you have to do better. All right. So, we'll call it a video. All right. So, till the next time and such. This has been the DoNotGod.com video presentation. And, we'll just keep at it and see where it goes. See what happens. And such. Guess I can do this much. Well, that's kind of an abrupt ending. But that's the way it, that's what it did. Okay, so till the next time and such and so forth and whatnot.